problem here, and we have to ask ourselves why we're willing to subordinate the truth to having access to power.
And you mentioned Justice Brett Kavanaugh. You also wrote about Christine Blasey Ford, who had accused him of inappropriate behavior, and also Anita Hill.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have the center of the book be some reflections on Me Too, on the ways that it worked, on the ways that it didn't work, on the ways in which it is substituted for having meaningful investigations and due process. And so I really wanted to think about Christine Blasey Ford as an avatar for the proposition that people believed her. I was in the room when she testified. I don't think anyone in the room thought she was lying. But nevertheless, Judge Kavanaugh was elevated to the Supreme Court and went on this spring to be a vote to overturn Roe. And so I think we disserved both Dr. Ford, who took, I think, a huge risk, and I think we served Judge Kavanaugh by not having any meaningful investigation. And so what was the point of all of that other than, I think, to have this kind of public forum that was not a formal legal process, and then step over Dr. Ford and say, oh, well, bygones. And now we are, you know, locked into a Supreme Court probably for decades that will be disrespectful of women's rights.
We just have a minute, but you also profiled Stacey Abrams and Roberta Kaplan. Why?
Again, I wanted to have a Black woman, a white woman, somebody who was at a big law firm, somebody who was an organizer. I think I just want
You're every tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector at kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council candidate Rene Gonzalez appeals his $77,000 fine from campaign finance officials. The first civil jury trial on Portland police protest violence begins, and in international news, sabotage is suspected in the rupture of an important oil pipeline in the Baltics. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 28th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Portland's small donor election program gave City Commissioner candidate Rene Gonzalez a record $77,000 fine for violating campaign finance rules last week. Now, Gonzalez wants to appeal their decision. The program looked at the 96% discount, or $6,800, that Gonzalez is receiving on office space as a violation of the program's limit on in-kind contributions. That resulted in the $77,000 fine. Gonzalez has received over $370,000 from the small donor program so far. In his appeal on the fine, he contends that the value of the property is much lower given current conditions in the area in downtown Portland. His office said the true value of the property, which they've been renting since May, would not exceed the $5,000 limit on in-kind contributions in Portland's campaign finance rules. The total fine of $77,140 is nearly half of the $175,000 that campaign records show Gonzalez currently has on hand. The 3,000-square-foot office space on Southwest 11th was offered to the Gonzalez campaign by Portland real estate billionaire Jordan Schnitzer. The first civil lawsuit to make it to a jury alleging excessive force by Portland police in 2020's racial justice protest began yesterday in Multnomah County Circuit Court. Protest medic Aaron Wenzel says an officer ran at her and violently slammed her with his nightstick on August 14th, even though Wenzel said she was following police orders. Wenzel then was allegedly pushed to the ground and struck by two other officers when she tried to get up. She broke her arm and injured her wrist, face, and torso. She seeks damages of $500,000. Lawyers and advocates are watching this case closely because it's the first case of its kind to make it to a jury trial. Other civil suits have been settled out of court by the city. Observers are interested in what the judge will allow as evidence, what tactics city attorneys for the defense will employ, and how juries will react. Already, city attorneys have called Wenzel's account into question, citing her inability to name the officer that hurt her. They also cited the lack of video evidence. Wenzel's lawyers say, though, that doesn't mean it didn't happen, since Portland police didn't wear name tags to keep them from being identified by the public. The trial is expected to continue through October 3rd. If you haven't bought gasoline recently, be prepared for pump shock. Oregon gas prices are jumping 50 cents a gallon after 3 months of stable prices. This rise to a statewide average of $5.14 a gallon is the largest of any state. The sudden jump is due to several refineries in California and Washington undergoing maintenance, slowing production, and tightening supply on the West Coast. National gas prices are also increasing because of lesser production in the Gulf of Mexico because of Hurricane Ian. Oregon now has the third highest gas prices in America, behind California and Hawaii, while Mississippi enjoys $3.07 a gallon. That's the lowest in the country. A major gas-fired power plant has been nixed in Oregon. The plant was proposed to be placed in eastern Oregon, but it ran against the state's goals to drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the coming decades. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Oregon has officially axed a gas-fired power plant near the Columbia River. The Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council terminated the site certificate for their proposed perennial wind chaser station in Umatilla County. Audrey Leonard is with Columbia Riverkeeper and says the decision is a victory for the climate.
If built, the facility would have been one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in Oregon. Over its 30-year life cycle, the plant would have emitted at least 30 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution, which means it also would have locked the state into 30 more years of reliance on fracked gas.
Plans for the plant date back to 2015. Since then, Perennial Power Holdings, the company behind the plant, has struggled to find a buyer for the power that would be generated. Since it was first announced, the state has committed to strong climate goals. In 2020, Governor Kate Brown directed state agencies to cut carbon emissions in Oregon by 80% within the next three decades. Leonard says the decision came after a lot of hard work from the communities that opposed the plant.
The victory really belongs to those who came out and spoke out and filed comments and really did the hard work there.
She says the fight over fracked gas and polluting energy sources isn't over in Oregon. She points to the GTN Express project, which would increase the capacity for fracked gas along a 1,300-mile-long pipeline running from British Columbia to California. Oregon, Washington, and California are calling on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to reject this project. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
FEMA officials warn Floridians to prepare for flooding from Hurricane Ian, and a bill to reform the certification of presidential elections gains bipartisan support. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
This is 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Floridians are going to experience the impacts from this storm for a very long time.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell on Tuesday warned those in the path of Hurricane Ian to heed the warnings of local officials and evacuate. The storm is expected to slow down when it hits the west coast of Florida Wednesday morning, bringing extended periods of damaging winds and rain.
We're talking about impacts in a part of Florida that hasn't seen a major direct impact in nearly 100 years.
Criswell said FEMA has prepared resources and personnel for rescue and recovery efforts. An estimated 2.5 million people are under evacuation orders. The Senate began work on a short-term spending bill to avert a government shutdown. Democrats removed a provision from West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin aimed at streamlining construction of energy projects after Republicans criticized its inclusion. The spending package includes more than $12 billion for emergency aid to Ukraine. Congress faces a September 30th funding deadline.
Both sides want to continue time-sensitive support for Ukraine, but unfortunately, our Democratic colleagues decided to put in extraneous partisan language.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would back a bipartisan electoral count reform bill. The support of Republicans like McConnell improves the prospects for the legislation, which aims to prevent overturning the results of a presidential election in Congress. The measure is a direct response to efforts to stop the certification of the 2020 election. Meanwhile, the House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol announced it will postpone a hearing scheduled for Wednesday due to Hurricane Ian's expected impact on Florida. President Joe Biden said Americans will soon pay less in monthly premiums for the Medicare Part B and no more than $35 for a one-month supply of insulin.
Many of us have been trying to fix this problem, but for years, Big Pharma has stood in the way. Not this year. This year, the American people won and Big Pharma lost.
Biden said lower costs are the result of the Inflation Reduction Act, which Congress passed last month. The rare 3% decrease in monthly premiums will kick in next year, bringing the average to about $165 per month. Students held walkouts across Virginia in protest of Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's proposed changes to policies regarding transgender students. Youngkin has proposed the state no longer allow students to use facilities marked for their identified gender. Students would also be required to file legal documents in order to be called by their desired pronoun. Finally, a libertarian group has filed the first legal challenge to President Biden's plan to cancel student debt, claiming it would raise state taxes for those who have their debt forgiven. For Public News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our 8 trust indicators on transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
FEMA has been helping Florida tribes brace for Hurricane Ian, which made landfall as a Category 4 storm this afternoon. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is working with tribes on preparedness efforts as Florida braces for Hurricane Ian. Lars Krutak is FEMA's National Tribal Advisor at the National Response Coordination Center. He says they're in close contact with the Seminole Tribe, the Miccosukee Tribe, and the Porch Band of Creek Indians in Alabama.
We continue to message that all tribal members ensure they have an emergency plan in place and to check in on neighbors to see if they need assistance. People with access and functional needs, including older adults, may need extra assistance to prepare for the storm. For people with disabilities and their families, it is important to consider their circumstances and their special needs to effectively prepare.
FEMA has supplies and personnel ready in different locations in Florida and Alabama to get help where it's needed as soon as possible, including with water, meals, and cots. The agency is encouraging people in evacuation zones to have a plan for their families and pets and be ready to evacuate. FEMA's tribal coordination includes working with the Interior Department, the Indian Health Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the American Red Cross. As of Wednesday morning, the National Weather Service warning showed Hurricane Ian was approaching the west coast of Florida. The life-threatening storm is likely to have devastating wind damage, flooding, and tornadoes are possible in central and south Florida. A tribal college in Wisconsin is highlighting a milestone and efforts to improve student success. Mike Moen has more.
This fall, the College of Menominee Nation kicked off a year-long celebration as it observes its 30th anniversary. School President Christopher Caldwell says it's important to display how much of an asset the campus is to the community. He says part of that plays out in welcoming Indigenous students who didn't have a good experience in trying out a mainstream college or university.
And so they come back home, they might not have their degree, or they come back with debt.
Caldwell says schools like his closely work with these students, and he hopes their welcoming environment rubs off on mainstream campuses. He says places like CMN are also important because they can educate the community about a local tribe's history. This year's celebration coincides with the 50th anniversary of the Menominee Restoration Act of 1973. That policy reversed an earlier decision by Congress to terminate Menominee status as a federally recognized tribe. Caldwell says it's an important story to keep telling.
We really, as an academic institution, represent the intent of that act in all of the efforts of what our tribal nations look to do, which is to assert their sovereignty, their self-determination.
And he says they're working to revitalize traditional aspects of the Menominee language and culture. That coincides with similar efforts around the country to prevent indigenous languages from going extinct as a number of tribes lose their elders. Caldwell says it's a key example of the role an institution like his can play and something other colleges can learn from. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with investigative reporter Piper McDaniel from Street Roots about her coverage of two of the Oregon congressional races for the 1st and the 3rd districts. Stick around at 6 for the underground, then at 8 it's drinking from puddles. Tonight's weather has a chance of rain after 7 p.m. and an overnight low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow, clouds and a chance of rain continue with a high of 70. Today in history, in 2019, the International Day for Universal Access to Information was proclaimed by the UN. It was formerly celebrated and called the International Right to Know Day. It pushes states to create greater information transparency and right to information laws. The quote of the day is from American R&B and soul musician Ben E. King. He was born today. He's best known for his hit song, Stand By Me, amongst others in his storied career. King said, quote, "You were able to sing something they related to instantly because it was part of what you felt. It was part of what you'd already traveled through. It's part of the people you were associating with daily. It was all of that." Large amounts of Russian natural gas have been bubbling into the Baltic Sea since Monday through three separate leaks on two Nord Stream pipelines. Seismologists recorded explosions where the pipeline passes the island of Bornholm on Monday morning and evening, which suggests sabotage. At this point, it's unknown who or what caused the explosions. The pipelines supply Germany, Scandinavia, the Baltics, and other European countries with natural gas. German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht said, quote, "The presumed act of sabotage on the Baltic Sea pipelines has again made clear how reliant we are on critical infrastructure, including that below water," end quote. Norway's Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre said that Norway is increasing its military presence at Norwegian installations as the country is now Europe's largest supplier of natural gas. Norway has reported a number of recent sightings of unidentified drones or aircraft inside the safety exclusion zones around some of their oil and gas facilities. How the United States does trade with certain countries could be transformed under a new framework taking shape. The Indo-Pacific Economic Framework has efforts to broaden the focus beyond just exports, but some worry traditional trade methods will win the day, hurting the ability to regulate pesticides at a time when there's growing concern about their impact. For more on the relationship between pesticide regulation and international trade, we go over to Mike Moen.
The U.S. is talking with several nations as part of an emerging framework for trade policy. But in the Midwest, there are concerns about the ripple effect on farmers and consumers when it comes to pesticides. The Indo-Pacific Economic Framework involves more than a dozen countries and has four negotiating pillars, including decarbonization and anti-corruption. While there are motivations to move away from standard trade ideals, Steve Supan of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says influence from large agribusiness firms still might complicate things. Pesticides is one of them.
Some of the IPEF countries have pesticide policies that are rejecting U.S. imports that have pesticide residues on horticulture and grain exports.
He predicts that will lead to calls for the elimination of zero-tolerance policies, with companies arguing they'll disrupt the delivery of food. There's added concern these discussions will happen behind closed doors. The Pesticide Action Network says the U.S. already has lax pesticide rules, and states like Iowa do not strongly enforce existing guidelines. It says that impacts a farmer's health and food safety. The network's Rob Fox, who also has a farm in Iowa, says the U.S. and its agriculture sector have become too used to the reliance of pesticides.
We've gotten to the point where we're blasé. It's just a pesticide, and we use it all the time.
Fox points to a proposal in Congress, the Protect America's Children from Toxic Pesticides Act, as a way to incorporate incremental improvements. He says it would give regulators more teeth to keep harmful products off the market.
That would change the process of both registration, making it a little bit more difficult, a little more burden of proof to show that it's safe, and then removing the chemical if it does show that there are dangers and problems with it would become easier.
While the future of the bill is uncertain, supporters say it also protects local governments and their ability to adopt their own pesticide rules. Some in Congress have been fighting a patchwork of regulations. Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
A three-week evidentiary hearing is underway in a case where multiple plaintiffs and their families allege that cell phone use caused brain tumors. Suzanne Potter has more on the lawsuit.
Evidentiary hearings are underway in a Washington, D.C. courtroom this week to decide if a massive lawsuit against the cell phone industry will be allowed to go to trial. Multiple families are suing most of the major wireless companies and their trade association, asking for hundreds of millions in damages, claiming cell phone use causes brain tumors. Plaintiff Monique Solomon Martinazzi's husband, Andy, passed at age 43 from a brain tumor that developed right where he used to hold his cell phone.
When cell phones first came out, he got one of the original battery-held Motorolas, and it was held to his ear 6 to 7 hours a day. He was in commercial real estate, and we just felt so strongly that that was the reason the brain tumor developed where it did.
The Industry Trade Association and Motorola did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but they have said their products are safe and comply with all government standards. But the lawsuit claims the FCC standards are outdated and points to a massive government study showing that exposure to cell phone radiation can cause brain and heart tumors in rats. Industry lawyers argued in court that if cell phones caused cancer, we'd be seeing an epidemic of tumors. Plaintiff Ellie Marks, whose husband Alan has had two brain surgeries so far, says the industry and the government are ignoring the evidence.
There is a rise in primary brain tumors, especially gliomas, especially in the younger population. These tumors used to only be seen in those over 65. Now we're seeing people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s perishing from this.
The families are claiming wrongful death, personal injury, and loss of consortium. Joel Moskowitz, Ph.D., is the director of the Center for Family and Community Health in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. He says if a U.S. court rules that cell phone use leads to brain cancer, the implications are huge.
And it probably would lead to many additional cases being filed by brain cancer victims. It also may force our government to finally take this issue seriously.
In related news, a judge in Canada recently ruled that a class action lawsuit can go forward against Apple and Samsung. The plaintiffs claim the phones emit more than the allowable levels of radiation and that the defendants knowingly harmed users. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
New research shows support for climate change mitigation policies is greater than most people think. The gap between perception and reality tends to cause many to remain silent instead of engaging others on the topic. Brett Pivato has the details on this widespread misconception.
The political divide over climate change seems well entrenched, but a recent study suggests the conventional wisdom is wrong. The study published in Nature Communications shows support for climate policies much higher than most think. While the average person believes support for climate action is around 43%, researchers found the actual level is between 66 and 80%. Sergio Vargas, a climate policy organizer with the Illinois Environmental Council, says our sense of isolation is a roadblock.
I think the big problem that the study suggests is it's very hard to rally these people together because they feel like they're alone in this fight, when in reality, there's so much support that exists.
The study uses the term pluralistic ignorance to describe that shared misperception. It calls the false idea an impediment to collective action. Researchers found that in every state and in every demographic studied, Americans underestimate the support for climate action. Study co-author Greg Sparkman of Boston College says people tend to confirm conform to what they think others believe and don't bring the issue up.
By not talking about it, we kind of confirm to people who are looking at us that people don't seem to be concerned. And then the cycle kind of continues where I don't think others are concerned, and because no one talks about it, and you get what's called a spiral of silence.
The study looked at a carbon tax, citing renewable energy policies on public lands and the so-called Green New Deal. It found supporters of climate action outnumber opponents 2-1, but Americans falsely perceive nearly the opposite is true. Sparkman says policymakers underestimate the support for laws that could make a difference. He notes the study found that conservatives underestimated support the most, but liberals do as well. He says television can be another factor in confirming bias if people don't watch programs that show people who care.
Or if they do, they're kind of portrayed as maybe an idiosyncratic character who's weird in their concern about the environment, and maybe they're the butt of a lot of jokes or something like that. I think these kinds of portrayals might be a disservice to portraying the fact that a supermajority of Americans are actually worried about climate change.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
Artificial islands could provide a refuge for people threatened by sea level rise, but constructing them can damage underwater ecosystems. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Maldives is a nation made up of over 1,000 small islands in the Indian Ocean. Most are very threatened by sea level rise. But one is in far less danger, a man-made island called Hulhumale. The Maldivian government built Hulhumale to relieve overcrowding by creating space for new housing.
Hulhumale used to be a reef bed. And what they did is that they dredged sand from the surrounding area or shipped it in, and they built it up until it was about 2 meters above mean sea level.
Sally Brown of Bournemouth University in England helped the Maldivian government assess how sea level rise will affect Hulhumale. Her team found it's likely to stay safe for most of the century, and longer if protected by a seawall. Brown says building the island damaged the reef bed and temporarily clouded the water with sediment. But as small islands explore options for population growth amid sea level rise, artificial islands such as Hulhumale could provide a solution.
Building an island from scratch has many advantages because you can control the height of the island when you build it. So although it's a lot of investment at the time and the ecological impacts can be really significant, it can bring long-term benefits.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is feeling connection overload.
When we're this interdependent, no one is free. So much talk about supply chains, toilet paper, pasta, used cars, but what about power? You can't blame it all on Russia sabotaging their own pipelines, cutting off natural gas from Europe and grains from a good part of the world. Where does your electricity come from? Your heat for winter, the gas for your car? Is voting a power when it can be controlled by misinformation, misdirected rage, inaccessible ballot boxes? Who has the power to do that? Deny the results of our votes? Blame it on greed, power hunger, and globalism. When money's so fluid, it doesn't care about anywhere. Doesn't matter what a couple billion people can't afford, only what they need, not what we might do to one another. Freedom's more than just a word, and though underpaid and overworked, we still have a lot to lose. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 28th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Eric Leuschner. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Brett Pivato, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're speaking with Piper McDaniel from Street Roots about two important congressional races on the ballot in Oregon. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking with Street Roots reporter Piper McDaniel about her coverage this week on the Oregon congressional races in District 1 and 3. Welcome, Piper.
Thanks for having me.
It's a special year for races across the ballot because we just came from a redistricting process in 2020. Notably, that took Oregon's congressional seats from 5 to 6. And legislators redrew the boundaries of these districts. So let's start with District 1, which you wrote about in this week's issue of Street Roots. What does District 1 encompass now?
Right. So Oregon's first congressional district now and to date has encompassed Clatsop, Columbia, Washington, and Yamhill counties, as well as parts of Multnomah. So it's roughly 865,000 people that make up the first congressional district.
So let's get to the candidates. One of those is, of course, the incumbent Democrat Susan Bonamici, who is challenged by a first-time Republican candidate, Chris Mann. So let's start with him. What is his background with politics? Where is he coming from?
So Chris Mann is a Republican, fairly conservative, and he does not have a political background. So this is the first time that he is running for office. He has never held office before. In a questionnaire that he filled out on Ballotpedia, he actually noted that he felt that this was a strength because it meant that he wasn't a career politician. He served in the military for 21 years, and in 2014, he became the executive director of Oregon Military Support Network, which is a nonprofit that serves veterans and their families. And he noted that he was an Uber and a Lyft driver.
And Bonamici, who he's challenging, has held office since 2012, so she definitely has a background in politics. What are some of her accomplishments?